I love rummaging through boxes. Actually, nothing gives me more joy than just opening a box and going, so what have we got? Because actually, a lot of the time, I will always find interest in something, however mundane it is. And I think you've got to be that kind of person anyway to be in my role.
From Brighton on the English South Coast, these are the voices of the Royal Pavilion and Museums with Dr. Sophie Frost.
The final episode of this series goes behind the scenes with Dan Robertson, curator of local history and archaeology at Royal Pavilion and Museums. By the end of this interview, I definitely come to consider Dan as a kind of museum sleuth. He constantly speaks of the investigative nature of his work, of how it's about unpicking puzzles, piecing things together, clawing out history and going down rabbit holes. Enviable tasks for those inclined to detective work. So without further ado, over to Dan.
I'm Dan Robertson. I'm curator of local history and archaeology at Royal Pavilion and Museums, a position that I've been in since, I think, 2016. Local history and archaeology. It's quite wide-reaching, actually. So obviously there's kind of all the local history gubbins that will include your photographs and ephemera and folk life objects, blimey. There's a lot more to it than that. Archaeology, which is, well, you know, quite extensive. It also includes Egyptology, which is fascinating. But I also look after oral history, which is a thing that I've kind of taken on fairly recently. Firearms, which is a new one. Basically, if it doesn't live in any other collection, it falls into local history. So I look after it.
Could you say quickly why Brighton particularly has got an Egyptology collection?
Oh, I think I can try with that one. No, actually, it's got a really interesting background. There were two brothers. One of them became a very famous Egyptologist, Francis Llewellyn Griffith. And there's actually a whole society named after him. But he went on some digs in the early 20th century, some of those which Brighton Museum and other museums funded. I think he was closely linked with Oxford University, actually. And a whole lot of stuff was collected and deposited in various museums around the country, those that funded the excavations. So large chunks of it came out of those excavations, but also just the relationship with him and his brother, Arthur Foster Griffith, who was an alderman, so local councillor. He was a keen supporter of the museums, particularly Brighton Museum and the Booth Museum. And through that relationship, the family just amassed an Egyptology collection, parts of which were sort of donated over the years. But I think when he passed away, actually, a lot came in then. It's a relatively significant collection for a museum service such as our size, which has been researched in fair amount of detail over the past sort of 15 years, I would say. But yeah, it was probably in the glory days of the museum, I guess, sort of going out and collecting material like that. And the fact that they're both Brightonian and they studied at Brighton College, where their father was the head, I think that's quite an interesting story, which actually their lives haven't perhaps been showcased too much, although I know some of my colleagues previous years have gone to lengths to try and promote that a little bit.
Well, there's loads I want you to talk about, but the firearm.
Firearms, yeah.
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 Who was that? Is that also something we funded back in the early 20th century?
I think firearms have been more ad hoc. There hasn't been kind of proactive collecting of firearms. Again, it's a collection that I'm trying to sort of learn my way around. But yeah, over the years, there have been a few collectors. I think one of them has the surname Dick, which, you know, we can laugh about that one, maybe. I think that collection, the Dick collection, there's pointy objects amongst it. So we've got your edged weapons, so daggers, dirks, dress swords, other swords, that kind of thing in there, and some really unusual firearms and other weapons. Royal Armouries have sort of expressed an interest in that, So one of my colleagues invited a researcher down from the Royal Armouries to take a closer look. Yeah, it's a fairly interesting collection, but there's a couple of notable objects amongst it. And one of them is this holy water sprinkler that may date from the time of Henry VIII.
Wow.
Could be one of only, I think, three of its kind known about in this country.
Hang on. A holy water sprinkler.
Yeah.
What's that got to do with firearms?
Yeah, it's gunpowder fired, and it fires out at all angles into, I guess, a crowd of people. I don't know the mechanics precisely behind it, but I think in my role, it's probably good to get in that I need to be a bit of a jack of all trades and yeah, just sort of pick things up as I go. So I'm not particularly specialist in any area in particular, although in terms of local history, I know Brighton a bit, so that helps. But firearms are really interesting. And actually, one of the stories that I would like to research a bit more is a Mauser that we have. It's just a handheld pistol, but originally it had its own case, and it would have had a long-range extension on it, I guess. That was taken off a German officer in the First World War, and his name is Count Felix von Luckner.
What a great name.
And yeah, he has an amazing story, which it would be great to sort of publish and get out there. He was a sea admiral, I guess, and he had a ship called the Sea Adler, and it was disguised as being, well, I think it was Norwegian originally, but basically he sailed through the Atlantic down to the Pacific, and he waged war without killing anyone. So he would capture ships, well, Allied ships, so French, British, would capture all of the crew and then scuttle the ship and then just drop them off somewhere. But yeah, he was a gentleman of the sea.
Was he supposed to kill them?
Well, I think he just took steps not to.
Okay.
The thing is, obviously, the First World War's time of submarines, U-boats, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. which the British viewed as being sort of very... well, unsportsmanlike to use that kind of technology when waging war. Not seeing your enemy and then just being torpedoed was, yeah, not great. But then, you know, obviously we took lengths to do the same in time. But yeah, Felix von Luckner, he did things a bit different. He was quite a rogue as well. So he was captured and escaped, and he was recaptured and escaped again around the likes of, I think, Fiji and that kind of area. But we ended up with his Mauser. I know that the National Museum in New Zealand has a sextant that was made by one of his crew prior to their second escape, I think, from captivity, so that they could make their escape and guide themselves away by the stars. It's a very remarkable story, but that when they were recaptured, his weapon was taken from him. Apparently, those that captured him were unarmed, but he didn't put up any resistance. But how we ended up with the Mauser is very unusual, because it was donated to us, I think, 1923 by a W.R. Bristow. His daughter is still alive, but she's, I think, 92 now, and would like to know how he got hold of this weapon and then subsequently donated it to the museum. And it's just a story that has been on the back burner, really, and I would love to piece together just so that we can sort of tie up and join the dots.
How would you even begin to follow up Felix von Luckner? Like, where do you think you might begin?
Yeah, well, I had a chance meeting with a lady who dropped into the museum, I think 2 years... God, this has been going on for some time. Maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago, in a drop-in session down at Brighton Museum. Where we just invite the public in to see what we get up to, so working on collections, that kind of thing. She just popped in and had these photographs and said, oh, these were produced by Spink, a local photographer, late Victorian, would you like them? I'm in New Zealand. I got talking to her and she knew the story. She knew the story of Felix von Luckner and used to work in museums as a museum educator. She had links with the National Museum. That was kind of a lead, and she gave me all of these contacts and said, I think her husband had researched it a little bit as well. So that was kind of the in, really, to sort of approach the museum and say, this is something that we have, I like what you do, and you've got the sextant, shall we follow up? everything else has kind of got in the way of doing that for some reason. I should have striked while the iron was hot, really, but it's still there. I mean, these objects aren't going anywhere. I will make a note of to sort of follow that up this week, actually.
So you don't know what happened to Felix von Luckner?
He was captured, but after the war, I think he just carried on sailing, actually. And he was sort of quite well known, and back home in Germany, obviously with the Nazi regime and what was happening in the 30s, he was regarded as a national hero, but I think he didn't think much of the Nazi regime and what was happening. And supposedly, during the Second World War, he aided the escape of a Jewish lady out of Germany. His hometown apparently was marked to be blitzed by US military, and apparently he arranged for the town to be left off this list of targeted sites. Not too sure how much of that is true.
That's incredible. Yeah, if it is true. Can we see the Mauser now? Is it on display?
No. So a very, very small percentage of the firearms that we have in our collections is on display. So I think between all sites, we've probably got, I think, 3 weapons on display. The thing is, we sort of need to display things in context. We're all about stories. I think there are objects in our collections which are probably more difficult to reason their display. Although we could potentially have a firearms display, but why are you doing that? We've got opportunities to get things out that don't see the light of day often. So Heritage Open Days, that's an opportunity for objects that rarely get seen to come out. We're making a move to do that as an open day down at Brighton Museum. See, I love my job in that I quite like tidying. And I like puzzles. Yeah, a lot of the work that I do is just unpicking a really big puzzle. I particularly like the collections management element of my work and just trying to piece all manner of bits of information that might sort of send me off on a lead and uncovering things that may have been mislaid for years just through human error. And that can't be helped, you know, that's always going to happen. You can't guarantee that you're going to locate things 100% all of the time. But we have some things that are hugely significant, and we're hoping that they've not gone astray. But, you know, things have been loaned out in the past in the times of, well, when everything was paper-based documentation. But clearly when we moved to a computerized system, things didn't quite migrate as well as they could have done. And again, with subsequent new collections management databases, or systems, should I say, we're trying to tidy as much as we can. And apparently, just in the past week, again, another thing that I'm trying to follow up on, we have a gridiron, supposedly 16th century, that was supposedly the gridiron on which the Lewis martyrs were burnt.
Okay, you might have to talk me through
this. I'm going
to
have to talk you through that. So, 10 Lewis martyrs, I believe. So during the reign of Queen Mary of Scots, Bloody Mary, Protestants were being persecuted, and a number of Protestants in the local area, including Derek Carver of Brighton, were rounded up for practicing Protestants and were burned alive. This gridiron was supposedly located at a hotel in Lewis. I've been following it up on the past week. Sorry, I have to deal with many different things.
No, I don't know how you keep all these stories in your head. It's amazing.
Yeah. But it was located at this hotel for many years and was supposedly purchased by auction, I think, in the 1870s. And then it was donated to the very early museum. So we're still talking 1870s, 1880s. A label was found in one of our stores back in the 80s describing this object. The label appears to have the handwriting of Ralph Merrifield, who was active at the museum back in the, 1930s, 1940s, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
The label was passed to the former keeper of local history and archaeology in the 80s. That was the end of it, maybe. We don't know where this gridiron has got to, but it must be pretty sizable to have had persons burnt on it. But it's hugely significant because of the bonfire commemorations that take place every year. There's always a nod to what happened in Lewes back in the 1500s.
So that's something that people are burnt on. It's not used to brand people. It was.
Yeah. Well, gridirons would normally be used to sort of cook meat over. So it's just like a...
Oh, my goodness me.
Yeah. Yeah.
How could you have mislaid it?
Well, the thing is, when labels fall off of things, or if objects aren't physically marked with accession numbers, then someone will come along, look at it and be, well, what's that? We're very keen and proactively trying to reconcile collections information, but that starts with your whatever sort of database you're using, whether it's paper-based or Excel spreadsheet, but then you need your objects to be located in store and mm-hmm. they need to be marked or labelled somehow. And yeah, it's a sizable object, but we have many sizable objects. Funnily enough, lots that are made of wrought iron. It's one of those things which I'm hoping will show up. Oh, if we find it, all the bonfire societies in Sussex will love us.
Wow.
It's such an important story. It means like just anyone from Sussex, particularly the east side, because all the bonfire societies are pretty much this end, apart from Littlehampton. Sorry, guys. But, you know, being East Sussex born... Although Sussex is a big county, Burn. Anyway, it would be a fantastic thing to just get out on display. And actually, my manager, Richard, he has also an interest in bonfire societies and the like. I probably shouldn't divulge or share what he collects. But it's very niche. Actually, no, it doesn't matter. He collects fireworks, vintage fireworks.
Wow.
Yeah, no.
That sounds risky.
Oh, no, it's in safe hands. He is responsible for the Glynde Memorial Parade, setting up all the fireworks. So he's a proper pyro.
Okay.
and he dresses as a bonfire, which is great to see. But, yeah, he just loves it.
Okay.
But yeah, for all of us in the department, actually, local history and archaeology, it's one of those things that we just have to claw out. That kind of work has been done before, but I'm keen to just try and get our house in order from the point of having at least our paper documentation, our hard copy documentation on our collections management system,
mm-hmm.
which I've done quite a lot of work on in the past in different position. So when I was assistant curator, collections assistant, that was some of the work that I was doing, just spending days upon days just transcribing lovely handwriting into a database. But more of that needs to be done by volunteers these days. So,
okay.
Yeah. Our main object store is not in one of our museums, but I'm probably not obliged to give away its precise location.
Okay, that's fine. But top secret coordinates.
Top secret. basically, if we take anyone there, we have to blindfold them.
Okay.
And we do threaten them.
We don't want to start a manhunt for the gridiron. Okay.
Lots of people probably know where it is anyway. But to be honest, that's my dream, is to have a new purpose-built object store. It would just be so lovely to have something like what the Towner down in Eastbourne has, where mm-hmm. within their art gallery, they've got their store in the middle. You open these doors and you walk in and it's just so lovely, and they can do tours for the public
mm-hmm.
and they sort of make a bit of money, and we could do that, but we can't do that at the moment because we just can't.
Okay.
So the keep really helped us, because before the keep was built, 2013, we were keeping lots of the sort of paper-based ephemera stuff in stores at Preston Manor, down at Brighton Museum, and it's just wonderful having things in purpose-built storage where mm-hmm. we know that they will last certainly a lot longer than they would have done in these other stores.
Yeah, and it sort of seems to be a quite pressing concern, right?
Mm-hmm. I think it was about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years, I was just starting to clear out an office, knowing that there were some objects in there. And I uncovered a Sussex loop. A Sussex loop is a Bronze Age metal ornament, which may have been worn to go over the hand and be worn around the wrist, but we don't know for sure because they're quite narrow. So whether it's something for a child, not sure, but I seem to think that actually it might have been more to sort of tie up textiles with. Mm-hmm. But these things are quite rare. Only 43, I believe, have been found. And they're called Sussex loops because all but two have been found in the county of Sussex. And many actually come from the Brighton area. But there are distinct variations in their design between sort of wider Sussex and those found immediately within the Brighton area. So Sussex loops is kind of a general term, and you get some described as Brighton loops. And they are beautiful. And actually trying to sort of replicate one, well, they're made out of a single length of metal that's been shaped into this curved shape. But they are beautiful, and they're very hard to replicate now.
Right.
People have tried to give it a go, and they're quite something. We in the museum at Brighton have at least three, but one had been mislaid. Mm. It had been mislaid for a decade.
Okay, that gives us lots of hope for the gridiron. Okay.
I was sorting through this cupboard, and in a box, not labelled, was this missing Brighton loop. I walked through to my colleagues. I think Andy was there at the time, so Andy Maxted, who was curator of local history and archaeology as well. And his eyes lit up. He was just like, "Dan, you can go home now. You can take the year off." Because it's such an important object. The fact that we have misplaced it for so long wasn't very good.
Well, let's blame the 80s, you know.
I'd like to. Lots of wacky stuff did happen there, but, you know, they tried their best. Sorry. No, they did good, I think. It's just marvellous to uncover.
So why do you think they've only been discovered here? Because it was some sort of rite of ritual linked to the area? Or
the thing is, the metal workers of the time must have been viewed as magicians. In terms of, like, the people making this stuff, sages almost of metalwork. I must also put the record straight here. I'm not an archaeologist. You know, I'm kind of springing off my colleagues who are really enthusiastic for this stuff, and I am. It's just, it doesn't quite sink in as readily as postcards from days gone by. But clearly there was some significance in the local area. People who were skilled enough to make these objects would have been few and far between. But they would have gone around. The thing is, these things would have potentially been traded.
Mm.
But it's interesting that they are just found within the county, really.
Yeah.
The ones that we have in our collections, they were found as a hoard with other objects, including daggers and armlets as well. And they form part of the Black Rock Hoard. And so Black Rock is just east of central Brighton. There are others found. Or have been found. And actually, sorry, I should probably correct the number that we have in our collections, because I think we've got four in total.
Okay.
Can't recall if the one that I had found was from the Black Rock Hoard, so we've got three from that site. We've got one from Falmer Hill. And that's one of three, maybe four, that were found as a group. And the other three made their way to Morscombe Primary School when it was first built, 1925. So the finder had donated those other three. Those have gone missing. I think periodically we sort of check in with the school just to see if they've been uncovered, because actually all manner of things turn up in schools, as Rodine evidenced last week, with it being publicised that they've potentially found a Turner just in a cupboard.
Have they really? I didn't hear that.
Yeah, so that's quite a find. We're hoping that might come our way eventually.
with the Sussex loops.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. And were they donated in the 20s to the school for education purposes?
Yeah, I think it was the intention to set up a mini museum there, which is quite forward thinking for the time, I think.
Yeah.
I think that would have been a wonderful thing. It's just hugely significant objects, and sadly, well, someone might have lifted them.
Mm. Okay. Well, this is a call out then to anyone who happens to have a Sussex loop
yeah.
in their house somewhere.
God, I am like stuck record with some things.
Okay.
So I have basically picked up quite good knowledge of certainly the local history and archaeology collections through doing some of the retrospective documentation work. So going back to these big bound ledgers and transcribing them into MIMSI, our collections management system. And I transcribed the period from about 1888 up to 1920. I wouldn't be able to tell you how many donations, acquisitions that is off the top of my head, but it's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, I was going, oh, that's interesting. Oh, that's interesting. Must remember that and follow that up. But there are a couple of items which really stood out for me. A couple of objects relating to Warren Farm Well, which is the deepest hand-dug well in the world.
Okay.
It is sited in Wooding Dean, which is just a couple of miles from centre of Brighton. The well was an interesting undertaking. So basically the corporation at the time, so we're talking 1850s,
mm-hmm.
were in the process of building a new workhouse. So the huge workhouse that sits on top of Elm Grove, which overlooks the city. It's very imposing. But part of the workhouse development was to build an industrial school to house children of the workhouse inmates and to teach them the industrious skills of life. So quite regimented, but yeah. they would just give them skills in which to then go on into trades and not fall into relying on the guardians of the poor. The industrial school was built a little bit out of town. Wooding Dean back then, or Wooden Dean, wasn't much more than just a farm really, and a couple more farmsteads. Being so far out of town and needing to supply quite a bit of water to the inmates, the corporation decided against paying out to the private water company to pump water up Bear Road and over and down to this farm, thinking it would be quite costly. So they decided to sink a well themselves, little knowing that it would take 4 years to reach water.
Gosh, that's incredible. Okay.
Yeah. They just kept on digging and digging and digging. They even went sideways at one point. But basically, they were just so high above the water table, they weren't going to reach water for a very long time. And it was all done as kind of trying to cost cut. But actually, the town's coffers were really very much eaten into. And there was lots of criticism coming in. But the undertaking did sort of throw up a few interesting things in terms of scientific intrigue, and so there's lots of interest locally from sort of scientific citizens, that kind of thing. It took 4 years. I think it was the 16th of March 1862. There's lots of social commentary in the newspapers from the time, which makes it such an interesting story, actually. It's as deep as the Empire State Building is tall.
So they finally hit water.
Yeah. So for those doing the digging, to climb, well, it's 1,285 feet. So that's a whole load of ladders and scaffold to make your way back up. Quite something. And all by candlelight. It's just crazy.
And is the well still open now?
The well is still there. So it's just outside Nuffield Health Hospital.
Okay.
The wellhead, there's sort of a new brick surround and it's caged over. Apparently it's haunted, but obviously it would have been haunted. But yeah, for many years, well, it wasn't actually used for that long. Eventually water was pumped in because there wasn't enough capacity in the end. So the decision was made to pump water in, I think, within 10 years. But the objects that we have kind of help interpret... Well, certainly help introduce that story. So we've got a sample of green sand that was taken from such a depth, mm-hmm. and that's in a nice little glass vial with a cork and wax bung. And we also have a sample of water taken from the lowest depth, but over 150 years have passed since, almost. So yeah, that's dried up. So we're just left with dust. But I quite like that. I think that's quite nice.
There's a poetry to that, isn't there?
There is a poetry to that.
Okay.
And we've also got these cowrie shells, which I think are just commemorative. They can't have come up from the well, I don't think. But the cowrie shells commemorate the engineer. I can't remember his name off the top of my head. But the persons involved in its undertaking. They are carved out on the surface of the cowrie shells, and we've got two of those. We have commemorative medals, coins, and the newspapers, again, they're just fantastic. So I did a talk celebrating anniversary, at least, of finding water. But I just read out the newspaper article because it was so melodramatic and theatrical. It was just better to read that just as it was communicated to the public back then, to the audience that I had for the talk.
Yeah.
And it was really fun doing it, actually. The BBC, they had a good phrase. So they did like a little sort of visual to sort of say how far humans have sort of cut into the deep surface. And yes, the deepest scar into the world's surface made by hand is Warren Farm Well. That's how they've described it.
That's amazing. All of the stuff you've talked about is all about leaving traces, ultimately. Yeah. But also I was just thinking, as you were talking, how you keep all these stories in your head.
Yeah.
It must be a bit overwhelming. Like, what's going on in there?
I don't know. The thing is, it's very hard to switch off sometimes. I need to remind myself, for my own well-being, to just switch off. Mm. Particularly when I'm not at work, just to have the downtime, really. But I think it's hard because I want to continue engaging with various communities out there. Mm-hmm. And in my position, there has to be a bit of flexibility to continue doing that when I'm not at work.
Yeah.
And I'm quite keen to promote what the museum does and what we get up to. We need to shout about the good that we do. Otherwise, you know, we're just sort of sitting there and nothing seemingly changes. Mm-hmm. Apart from the exhibitions.
Mm.
I swear sometimes things come into my head and then get pushed out again. So it's very difficult, and you can just find yourself going down rabbit holes all the time,
which is amazing, really, and frustrating. But
yeah, well, I can understand why people envy the job that I do, because it's just massively interesting.
Mm.
I don't really indulge too much, and I've been sort of told that I should be doing my own research, really, in things that I take an interest in. So I wouldn't mind sort of doing more around disability history, because the history around the Royal Pavilion is a military hospital for Indian soldiers and disabled servicemen in the First World War is it's fantastic. But beyond that, what else was going on in Brighton? It's just really, really amazing.
Mm.
And I think since local history galleries have kind of been cut back, at Brighton Museum at least, we're not telling those sorts of stories anymore.
Yeah. Given that you're Brighton born and bred,
yeah.
What is it about Brighton and Brighton's history that is so fascinating from your perspective?
Yeah, I think the fact that we are on the coast.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wouldn't really want to live anywhere else. If I was too far away from the sea, I think I'd go a bit mad. But the fact that we're between the sea and the Downs is quite significant. We've got this proximity to Europe as well.
Mm.
And as a passing place, people migrate to and through. We've got the proximity to London as well. Just so many people bringing different ideas, coming to the town and passing through the place. You can escape the busyness of Brighton by walking along, well, going along the coast or onto the hills. I don't know. I think we're just very fortunate that we're where we are. I mean, we're built in three hills, I think, as some people like to remind people. It's quite a hilly place, and I grew up living on one of them, so it certainly kept me fit when I was younger. It's just got all these different moods to it as well, and I think Constable and Turner and whatever probably saw that as well. Really an amazing place to live.
Thank you very much, Dan. I really appreciate your insights.
That's all right. I should have said thank you.
My thanks to Dan Robertson for so generously sharing some of RPM's many historical intrigues with us. His seemingly infinite descriptions of Victorian Egyptologists holy water sprinklers, German Mausers, gridirons, Sussex loops, and the deepest hand-dug well in the world perfectly capture the unique and complex history of Brighton and of Royal Pavilion and Museums, and paid tribute to the Brightonian families that supported it and made these collections possible. I loved his final description of Brighton as a place of proximity both to London but also to Europe, as a place situated between sea and countryside, and as a place well-travelled, made up of fantastic capers and unexpected plot twists. So that brings us to the end of Series 2, which I hope you have enjoyed as much as I have. Please do stay tuned for the final series of Voices of the Royal Pavilion and Museums, which will be coming out later this year. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, hit like and subscribe, and please leave us a very nice 5-star review. Find out more about the Royal Pavilion Museums at brightonmuseums.org.uk and more about this project at oneby1.uk. On Twitter, I'm Soph_Frosty and RPM is Brighton Museums. I really hope you can join me next time. Till soon, goodbye.
The voices of the Royal Pavilion and Museums are supported by the oneby1 Research Project, the School of Museum Studies at the University of Leicester, The Keep, Arts Council England, and produced by Lo-Fi Arts. Lo-Fi Arts.